Good afternoon. This is the professor, Dr. Ron Daniels, president of the Institute of the Black World 21st Century and distinguished lecturer emeritus from York College, City University of New York. I welcome you to this June 20th special edition of Vantage Point here on 99.5 FM, that's WBAI, on the Pacifica Network in collaboration with ycradio.org, that is the York College radio station. Special edition because today we're going to be dealing with reflections on the life and legacies of Reverend Dr. C.T. Vivian and, of course, Representative John Lewis. Our special guest joining us momentarily will be the Reverend Mark Thompson, who is a dear beloved friend. I'll introduce him later. But before we do that, again, we just want to encourage people to be safe, to be sharing with each other, to be caring. A lot of danger out here with this virus, particularly when you have Agent Orange passing out misinformation all over the place. We also just want to say happy birthday to Paradise Gray. Paradise Gray, the founder of the Black Watch movement back in the day, and of course the co-founder of X-Clan. And of course, we actually had anticipated him being on today, but because of the transition of these two civil rights icons, we are going to have him on next week. We also just want again to say WBAI Buddies. We just heard the announcement about WBAI Buddies, the technical difficulty we sometimes have. We just need your support. Today I'm looking for 5 WBAI Buddies. I'll come back and make my strong appeal later, but line up. Well, you can just call right now, 516-620-3602, 516-620-3602, to become a WBAI Buddy. They'll tell you how to do it. It's a sustaining contributor, a minimum of $10 a month, $120 a year. So it comes right out of your credit card, your debit card, checking account, savings account. You can make it happen, and we need your support in order to make it happen. I also just want to remind people of the Community Cares listening line. We heard a talk about that. We really, really want people to spread the word about the Community Cares listening line, which, of course, is put together by the Institute of the Black World 21st Century. And that number to call, and call and test it out this evening, 877-719-1117. That's 877-719-1117. That's the Community Cares listening line that is put together by the Institute of the Black World 21st Century. It's Black Family Summit. It's for first responders and essential workers. A lot of tension out there, a lot of trauma out there. We have culturally appropriate people who are from our community who will listen and then provide services if necessary in terms of counseling. So we really, really are trying to get the word out. I do hope that our PSA is running on WBAI. They're partnering with us on this project. 877-719-1117. Please call that number. Now I'm delighted to have joining me for this very, very special edition, my dear beloved friend for many, many years, longtime freedom fighter, Reverend Mark Thompson, who of course is the host of the podcast, Make It Plain, but much more than that. He is a activist and organizer in his own right, and he and I have worked together for many, many years. He is also a commissioner with the National African American Reparations Commission. But for the purposes of this conversation, Ashley, he and I have just worked together for many, many, many years in Selma with the Bridge Crossing Jubilee, working on different aspects of it, helping the organizers there, Five Rose Teray and Hank Sanders and all of them, to help coordinate a massive, massive event. One of the most significant events. In fact, it's the largest civil rights event every year, annual event. And he has played a leading role in that and continues to do so. So I'd like to now bring to the microphone Reverend Mark Thompson. Reverend Mark, welcome to Vantage Point.
Hey, brother, how are you? God bless you. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, we can hear you just fine. You're coming in loud and clear. So I am so happy you agreed to, on short notice, because I know you're doing interviews everywhere, to become a part of our show here on WBAI. Today, as we do reflections on the life and legacies of Reverend Dr. C.T. Vivian and Representative John Lewis. And what I'd like to do is, I'd like to do this in really three parts. First of all, I'd like to just do personal reflections. And then secondly, I want to talk about, you know, our assessment of roles in the civil rights, human rights movement and legacy. And then finally, I want to talk about what I call the bridge and the bill in relationship to not only Representative Lewis, but also someone else that we know and love, and that is Amelia Boynton. So, you know, what I'm going to do, I'm going to just start off and share with our audience. Let's start with C.T. Vivian. I just want to share my reflections, and I'm going to come to you, Reverend Mark. I first came to know C.T. Vivian in Youngstown, Ohio, back in the day. And I came to know him through Reverend Lonnie A. Simon, who was the pastor of the New Bethel Baptist Church. And the way I heard about him, we had an organization there, the Era of Black Power and Black Nationalism. And I heard about him through Reverend Simon, because Reverend Simon went to Chicago and he participated in C.T. Vivian's Urban Training Center for Christian Mission. And when you went to the Urban Training Center for Christian Mission, what you did was you got an immersion in poverty. You first of all got some overall training and orientation. And then my recollection is that you got a few dollars, and then you were left on your own in an impoverished section of Chicago for a week. And you just had to live like a poor person. Now, of course, you always had the privilege of knowing you're going to get out someday, but at least the idea was to let you know how poor people live. Reverend Lonnie A. Simon went through that experience, came back to Youngstown, Ohio. He was absolutely on fire. He came back as a trans. He was already reasonably progressive. He was actually a Republican, but a Jackie Robinson Republican. I have to make that notation, because there's so many crazies out here today that everybody thinks that these Republicans have always been that way, and there have always been other kinds of Republicans. Jackie Robinson was a Republican. There are many people who, blacks who were Republicans, who were moderate and progressive and all that good stuff. But Reverend Simon came back and he was on fire. That was good for us, because we had an organization called Freedom Incorporated. And we really needed a faith ally. And Reverend Simon became a staunch ally of Dr. Ron Daniels. I was not doctor then, but chairman of Freedom Incorporated. And we worked together for years and years and years and years. C.T. Vivian came to Youngstown, Ohio, when we launched something called Freedom Consumer Cooperative. It was an effort to build a cooperative food market. And then when I ran for mayor as an independent candidate in 1977, there came C.T. Vivian. He came and campaigned for me. And then I got to work with him even more closely with the Center for Democratic Renewal. A lot of people have forgotten about the Center for Democratic Renewal, which really was at the forefront of exposing this rash of church burnings while I was at the Center for Constitutional Rights. And then, of course, the voting rights, he was chair, I think he was chair of the Voting Rights Museum, and of course, saw him frequently on that. And then we invited him to come, as we had many, many, many powerful monthly forums at the House of the Lord Church, and we invited C.T. Vivian to come, and he spoke. And he was a tremendous orator. He came to the House of the Lord Church, welcomed by the Reverend Herbert Daughtry, to speak at one of our monthly forums at the House of the Lord Church. So that's kind of my kind of reflections on how I got to meet C.T. Vivian, how I got to know C.T. Vivian, and quite frankly, came to count him as a friend. We would call each other periodically. I hadn't really talked to him in a number of years now, but, you know, because he was 96 years old. But every now and then he would give me a call. I would give him a call. Reverend Mark, your turn. How did you get to know C.T. Vivian? What are your reflections?
Well, I got to know C.T. First of all, as you may recall, I was raised in Nashville, Tennessee, which was one of the bedrocks of the civil rights movement and the city movement. My mother was 16 when she was attending Pearl High School. And she used to try to sneak out of school every day to join John Lewis and Diane Nash and others down at Woolworths downtown. Mm. My mother was, again, only 16 and a very petite young lady. And so the faculty of Pearl High would conspire to catch my mother trying to sneak out of school. And that became kind of its own surreptitious underground civil rights movement. How could Janet Pettway escape to join the sit-in movement? How could the Pearl High faculty keep her from getting out of the building? And so growing up, I had always heard about what had happened in Nashville. Not only her involvement, but my family's involvement. And my grandfather had been, my mother's father had been director of admissions at Fisk University as well. I think he actually, if my dates are right, I think he became director of admissions right after John Lewis left or right when he graduated. And so John Lewis was known in Nashville. But as far as C.T. Vivian was concerned, during the Nashville sit-in movement, the training location for nonviolent direct action led by James Lawson, Reverend James Lawson, was the church in which I was raised, Clark Memorial United Methodist Church. Oh, wow. In fact, Dr. King held one or two of his SCLC annual conferences at Clark. And then Clark Memorial was where the trainings were held. In fact, Clark was a church where Meharry Medical College was founded in the 1800s. So Clark was where the church I was raised in was where the meeting was, where the sit-in trainings occurred. But it was First Baptist Capitol Hill that the mass meetings happened. And so whenever John Lewis, Andy Young, or Mrs. King, or Ralph Abernathy, or Rem Fonroy, or C.T. Vivian would come to Nashville on specific anniversaries when I was a child, we would go visit First Baptist. And hear them, including C.T. That's why I first heard C.T. speak. I must probably was about 10, 11 years old at First Baptist Capitol Hill.
Right.
By this time, my grandmother had divorced and remarried, and she remarried a deacon at First Baptist. And at her wedding, the very famous pastor of First Baptist Capitol Hill, Kelly Miller Smith Jr., a confidant of Dr. King, performed the wedding ceremony at Clark Memorial, where the pastor, Reverend W.C. Dobbins, the man who baptized me, was Dr. King's next door neighbor when he lived in Montgomery, when the house was bombed. So wow. These two, and he, Reverend Dobbins also led the Pensacola sit-in movement in Florida at his first pastorate. Before coming to Nashville to Pastor Clark. So you had these two civil rights activists performing my grandmother's second wedding. And so I was always up under them and learning from them. And they were surreptitiously training me, molding me, mentoring me for the ministry without telling me. Because, at that age, you don't want to discourage anybody. But they were kind of moving me in a direction and surrounding me. Nobody said, "Mark, we want you to be a minister." They allowed me to be called, but they put everything around me. So long story short, Kelly Miller Smith Jr. would invite the icons, including C.T. Vivian. And I would go hear him. And I was fascinated. Ron, I love to hear those stories. Yeah. And the way they told those stories were fascinating. And when they would come to First Baptist, even to preach a Sunday sermon, normally a preacher has a text and the 3 points. When those guys would come, you know what they would do? They would just tell the stories.
That's right.
And it was the sermon. And they would go step by step, blow by blow. And it fascinated me what C.T. would say and what he had been through, and to see the video of him. And then when Eyes on the Prize came out, I was totally enthralled with the story. And by this time in life, I had met my father. And we were in Washington, D.C. My father lived in Washington. I was watching The Eyes on the Prize one night at home with him. And he looked at me and he stopped. He said, you really fascinated by this, aren't you? And I said, yeah, this is our history. And the bug had bitten me. And so if you go back and look at my high school yearbook and all the, you know, nicknames they give high school, you know, those of us in high school in the yearbook, mine was junior civil rights leader. Because I was, you know, always involved and always fascinated in what was going on. So that was, you know, my connection to C.T. Vivian, first of all, before even John Lewis. And what was interesting was, you know, I never dreamed, as, you know, as I'm sure you didn't, at different points in your life. You see these people and you know how famous and what icons they are. But then you almost become, you start working side by side with them. And it's a trip. Now, wait a minute, I'm sitting here organizing with C.T. Vivian. I'm not supposed to be doing that. Who am I? But just like, you know, and some, I was talking to, I had a meeting on the phone with Rashad Robinson of colorofchange.org today. And we were talking about you, and he was like talking about what an icon you are. And I said, that's the good and bad about struggle. The good being that people like CT and John, and even you, have always been accessible to younger people like us. And I mean, I'm not as young as I used to be, neither is Rashad. But when we met you, we were young. And you were always accessible to us, just like they were, and just like CT was to you in your younger days. That's the sweet part. But the bitter part is this. It's also, frankly, folks, a reflection of our ongoing and endless struggle. So that people like CT and John Lewis and you, y'all don't have a chance to be lofty because you're still in the fight. And by the time the next generation comes along, you're still doing the same fight that you always were. And here we are to join you to help pick up the baton to continue it. So it's kind of, to me, a bittersweet type of thing that they never really were able to rest or to stop because so little had really changed and so much was taking us back in reverse, putting the car in reverse. So they had no choice. Well, listen, CT said, listen, I need Ron Daniels with me. And you were there for him and he was there for you. Or Mark Thompson or Rashad Robinson. So that, to me, is the their humility was beautiful, right, but absolutely. Also the necessity of that humility is born out of an endless struggle that we can never forget. If our oppression is so endless, then so must our vigilance be. Like Frederick Douglass said, it must be eternal.
That's right. Wow, man, that's incredible. That's good. That's the reason why I like to do these reflections because, I mean, I've been working with you for a long time. I never heard some of those great stories, man, about your background and how you got nurtured to be a minister and all that good stuff. So, man, this is wonderful. Let me talk about John Lewis, who I was not as close to John Lewis as I came to be to C.T. Vivian. But one of the great moments of my life, actually, is I was a became involved with the NAACP at a very young age. I talk about this in my book, Still on This Journey. I had done a lot of work in sort of juvenile delinquency prevention work in Youngstown, Ohio. Very young, 9, 10, I mean, 11, 12, 13 years old, recruited by a cousin to become a part of the NAACP. And I had I became president of the Youngstown chapter of NAACP. Eventually, I went on to be state chapter president, regional president, and I founded the chapter actually at Youngstown State University. But as a part of that, I had the privilege of going with the NAACP contingent to the March on Washington as a young kid. Could have been no more than 15, 16 years old. And what I can attest to, I remember it was such a, what an experience that was. I've often told people about hearing Odetta as we came in talking about singing Old Freedom and Peter, Paul, and Mary, they were singing. And then Joan Baez, there was always these folk singers, you know, there. And then the march itself. But what I remember was I can validate the discussion about the speech because it was circulating all through the crowd. They don't want John Lewis to speak. They're afraid he's going to be too militant. I mean, all that was like circulating up in there. And so, you know, he eventually did get up and speak, and he was strong and all of that. I didn't really remember much of what he had to say that day, but I do remember that there was real great anxiety about what he would say. And he was introduced by A. Philip Randolph. And I always tell people I remember A. Philip Randolph because he had that booming voice. And I will never forget him saying, "We are witnessing today a great social revolution," he said. I'll never forget that. So that was my first introduction, just indirectly, to John Lewis. And then back in Youngstown, and a lot of people maybe have forgotten this, but I remember this vividly, that John Lewis was relentlessly working on voter registration. He had an organization called VEP, the Voter Education Project. That was his organization for many, many years, a nonprofit. And I don't remember what was going on. Were we doing voter registration in Youngstown or whatever? But I may probably still have a letter or two, exchange of letters with him in my file, because we reached out to him in his capacity, not as the, you know, the person who was a congressman at that stage, but we reached out to him just in terms of his work around voter education. And of course, he knew a lot of folks who had been in SNCC and CORE, and we knew some of those people as well. And but I don't remember the specificity of what it is that I reached out for him about. And then later on, of course, he went on to become congressman. And one of the things that I remember is that, you know, when that seat was open, the person that the political establishment, the black political establishment, kind of wanted for whatever reason was Julian Bond. But it was John Lewis who outworked and did whatever. He had the base, much stronger base among the grassroots community, and of course he became elected to Congress of the United States. And then, you know, we would see him every year. You know, he'd come to Selma, and you know, I had occasion to see him, and he recognized me, and you know, and so forth. That we never really had a chance to sort of sit down, have a deep conversation, or whatever. But obviously, you know, a remarkable, you know, person. And I suspect that you probably, given your role with SiriusXM and then later on now with your podcast, and even before, I imagine you had an opportunity probably not only to meet him, but probably to interview him. So again, let's talk about your how you connected with and how you met John Lewis.
Well, of course it was through Selma. And again, I had encountered him on different occasions in Nashville as a very young person, and, you know, had an opportunity to hear him speak as well. And be amongst, you know, his contemporaries who knew my, you know, my mother and my grandparents and everything. But when we got to Selma, you know, John was accessible. And so, you know, we would interact in Selma, often informally. But it was in 2006. And in fact, it is on the podcast today, on the Make a Plane podcast. If you all go to makeaplane.com, it's there today. In 2006, I decided, I had an idea. And I said, "Congressman Lewis, let me mic you." And this was during one of our annual marches. You were there. I said, "Let me put this microphone on." He said, "What for?" I said, "We're going to be in this march today, but as we march, I'd like for you to describe everything that happened on Bloody Sunday every step of the way."
Oh, wow.
And he did. I don't know that there's any other recording like that that exists, but we're marching, and it's, you know how the marches are, Ron, and it was, so you hear all the ambiance of the march, you know, other people chanting the songs, the SNCC Freedom Singers. And it just so happened that Martin III was right next to Congressman Lewis and me. And so you even hear him talking. And it's just a very casual and informal conversation. this is what happened at each one of these points along the way. And it ended up being almost an hour.
Wow.
You know, because the march was moving along at a slow pace.
Yes.
And it's a much younger, a very energetic John Lewis. We have that up today for people who want to hear it at MakeItPlain.com. And it was something that he always valued and cherished because no one had really done that before. And it was radio. And this was even before I was on, on Sirius. I had started out on XM. And Sirius and XM were not merged yet. So I didn't really go on Sirius and XM together until 2007, maybe even later. So this was in 2006. And so we did that and always kept it. And every year I've aired that. But in 2019 in Selma, you know, things have changed in social media and his video. I said he came on a different day than the usual march with Faith and Politics. And I said, you know, the last time we did this, man, we just did audio for radio. There was no relationship between radio and video. I said, let's do this again, but let's do it on video this time. But it was no march taking place at the moment. It was just the two of us alone walking across the Edmund Pettus Bridge, Ron.
Oh, my
and
goodness.
And so he did it again. And little did I know that that would be our last walk across that bridge. And maybe probably the last time he was recorded on the bridge telling the story. But we walked across every step of the bridge, and he talked about what happened. And it's really a touching piece of video. I didn't know. And again, I did not know that would be it at the time. In fact, there was not even an announcement about his diagnosis yet in March of 2019. So to have had both of those experiences with him. And then we were very close. You know, John knew, you know, the role my mother had in my life and her role in Nashville. And John was right there when my mother passed. And we kept in touch that way, even on a personal level. We had a couple of very close personal friends. And even when we didn't talk, you know, I'd get a message, you know, sometimes once a week, hey, was on with John. He asked about you, Mark. And then I would send the same message back. But, you know, we were always, you know, on the same page and always together on a lot of things. And whenever we needed him to endorse something that we were doing in the movement, he would do it and vice versa. And then, you know, I guess it was not long after Trump came in office. Trump attacked John Lewis, and I went on television and defended John Lewis and kind of probably somewhat threatened Trump for attacking John. The Secret Service didn't come for me, though, for threatening the president. But I was like, you know, hands off John Lewis.
That's right.
And you are in no place to say anything about him or to attack him. Let me just share something else with you, too. I was very close with Kwame Ture and Mary Beth. And, you know, my uncle and my extended family through marriage was a part of the Mitchell family in Baltimore. So I was always hearing the stories about how SNCC was founded, Clarence Mitchell III, Kwame Ture, Marion Barry. I mean, I was blessed to hang out with all of those dudes regularly. And so I would hear all of the stories about what happened with SNCC, how Kwame won the presidency, the chairmanship of SNCC. Yeah, from John. And, you know, many people said John Lewis never really got over that. And he never said that to me. But whenever he talked about it, you could tell there was some sadness and regret in that, that he lost that. But it was always, those were some different, all those cats were different. They were all in the movement, but very different personalities. John Lewis, I mean, we talk about on extremes. John Lewis, Marion Barry, Kwame Ture, those were some very different dudes.
That's
and the
right.
connection to Nashville was Marion Barry went to Fisk. Too.
That's right.
And, yes. and when my mother's brother was undergrad at Fisk, getting ready to go to medical school, Marion was his graduate assistant teacher. And so they, the family knew everybody, and but it was just interesting to hear their different stories and to be amongst them and know that there were these differences between them, and yet they all led this very diverse organization.
Right.
That is powerful, you know, to know, to hear all that, to sit at the feet of those elders and to learn from them was probably one of the most meaningful experiences of my life.
Right.
Yeah, I would say that.
So let's now let's go back to CT. I mean, obviously, you know, CT is mentioned, but obviously John Lewis is getting a lot more of the play. But, you know, CT's role was a very critical role in SCLC and beyond. And you referenced it, but people may not remember that CT bore across his forehead. You know, he had a scar across his forehead where, and there's a scene, and it maybe is in Eyes on the Prize, I don't remember, but I know I've seen the video of him, you know, at the courthouse praying and appealing to Jim Clark, you know, to allow black people to register to vote. And he was rewarded by being cracked upside his head with a billy club, you know, in a way that was, I mean, just brutal and savage. And yet, you know, he survived that, you know, and he continued, you know, he continued to be a part of, and many people say he was a part of Dr. King's inner circle, whatever that means, because I guess everybody felt they were part of the inner circle, but he was certainly one of those lieutenants, you know, who carried on in King's legacy. And obviously the notion of the Poor People's Campaign, the issue around poverty, was one of the things that he seriously took up, because that's why he was in Chicago, like getting people to understand the nature of poverty and how it had to be addressed. And he just trained, as many of these folks did, like hundreds of people who came out influenced by, you know, the work of C.T. Vivian. So I guess I would want your reflections on just, you know, the role and the legacy of C.T. As you see it.
Well, again, you know, C.T. was, I mean, really a brilliant man. And, you know, I remember hearing him as a kid. As a minister, I was always impressed, because his cadence, his speech was very direct.
That's
and
right.
Very precise. You know, you know, some people have a lot of flourish when they preach or when they speak, but CT was very exact, and it was always about the work and the assignment and the mission. You couldn't listen to CT and not feel as though there was something you needed to get up and do, or something that you needed to be recruited into. And he was truly an organizer and an activist. He wasn't a celebrity. You know, some of these folks running around are celebrities and television stars. You know, CT didn't aspire to that. He was truly an organizer. The scene is on in Eyes on the Prize, and where he's struck by Jim Clark, and you know, you see where he's hitting the mouth, and he had to have 11 stitches and all of that. And you know, from a theological perspective, you know, growing up in Nashville, being around all this civil rights history, Ron, I had to write a thesis for high school, and it was about Dr. King's final year of life. And that became my theology. You know, I realized, and I said this on TV over the weekend, even though you're not supposed to talk about faith too much on mainstream cable television, but I did it anyway. And they kind of forgave me for it under the circumstances. You know, whatever your faith is, and some of you listening right now may not be religious, but there's still knowledge of the history of the faith. And so whether you're religious or not, everybody knows the history and the story that, you know, Jesus was crucified. And then the belief and the thought, the thinking, the education, the knowledge is that he died for the sins of the world. He shed blood for the sins of the world. But when I did my thesis on Dr. King, you know, I noticed, I said, well, wait a minute. Step by step, everything, going to Memphis, all of this, Jesus going into Jerusalem. It, what happened in Dr. King's last days mirrored the life of Christ. Well, I asked myself, well, why is that? But that became a part of my theology, to be on a quest to learn and understand that. And it says in Scripture, again, you may not believe this, but this is just what it says. This is factually written. It is written, believe it or not. Jesus said, whoever believes in me will do all the things I've been doing and even greater things than these. Mm. And so my theology became, well, even for those, and I always, you know, mess people up who are either agnostic or atheistic. I said, what if I told you that everything you've ever heard about Jesus, you could also do yourself? That trips people up. But like I said on television, America was a sinful place, still is. But in 1965, it was very clear America was sinful after what had happened in Montgomery and Birmingham and elsewhere. And then one of his greatest sins was denying us the right to vote. So on February 16th, C.T. Vivian shed blood for the sins of America when Sheriff Jim Clark hit him. Jim Clark in the role of the Roman centurions who had pierced Jesus in his side. So Jesus was standing up for an oppressed minority. Here was CT doing the same thing. You can't really separate that. What is that about? Why is that? One, that's February 16th. March 7th, just a few weeks later, a couple of weeks later, really. John Lewis and Hosea Williams and others and Amelia Boynton shedding blood for the sins of America. And so to me, it was always a challenge. Even the folks who called him said, oh, I'm so Christian. I said, well, you realize what John and CT did was the same thing Jesus did. Except Jesus actually died. They didn't. But it was still the shedding of blood for an oppressed minority. We got to think about this in terms of the political Christ as well. Not the, you know, blonde hair, blue-eyed one, but the political Christ. Right, and people are like, right. You know, wow, I never really thought about it in that way. And the other thing is important, you know, one thing that John, you saw, now CT and I never got a chance to talk about this. We never got a chance to. But, you know, John was involved on behalf of SNCC when Malcolm X went to Selma. And as you and I have always discussed, Selma was the clearinghouse for everything. Everybody came to
That's
Selma.
Right.
That was how significant it was. Even Malcolm. And John and I would always have this conversation, John Lewis and I, Congressman Lewis and I would always have this conversation about, well, what if? Because he knew, everyone knew the pregnancy of that moment and how close things came to Malcolm being more involved in the civil rights movement and sitting down in the pulpit of Brown Chapel with Coretta Scott King and teasing the possibility of working with Dr. King. And then, you know, and you know, there were even elders at the time who we would see years later who were there. And we could never verify their stories. They're gone now. But they would say that Malcolm talked to Mrs. King that day, and then Malcolm was driven to see Dr. King when he was in jail for a few moments, and that they made agreements. And you know, even Congressman, I said, Congressman, you think there's any relationship between Malcolm coming on February 4th and being killed February 21st? Mm-hmm. And, you know, he wasn't as conspiratorial as I probably am. But he would say, you know, brother, that's something to think about. It really is. But we would always just look at each other and say, man, what if? He's like, yeah, man, what if, you know? And if I have a strong feeling what direction that might have gone in had Malcolm been able to live. So when you look at Selma and all of the bloodshed, the martyrdom of Jimmie Lee Jackson, just days before C.T. Vivian is struck, and then the bloodshed on the bridge. So what you have is a Christ experience. And see, people need to reconcile that. What does that mean? Whether you are faithful or not, whether you are Christian or not. Well, wait a minute now. We have a mirroring experience with a story that is the oldest and greatest story and the best-selling book ever sold. So what meaning does that have? So even if you don't believe in that book, you have to believe in the power, as Reverend Jackson said, of unearned suffering and right. redemption in blood. And then when we expand it to our overall experience, beginning with the Maaf and slavery, that has been our experience. And so what do we do with that blood? How do we redeem it? How do we continue to build and struggle throughout it? And frankly, that struggle is longer than the struggle that's in the Bible. It predates what's in the Bible in terms of our current experience. So, and going back to colonization and slavery. So we are thankful, for these lies. And like I said, CT got hit first. Same devil, Jim Clark. Yep. Jim Clark hit yep. CT.
Right.
Jim Clark sicked the dogs and the troops on John Lewis. I don't know. You know, I'm a minister, so I have to pray, you know, that God will forgive those of their sins. So I don't know. I can't say for certain where Jim Clark is right now. But I know where CT and John Lewis ended up.
Right. Well, I just got a few more minutes left, and so I really want to now talk about the bill and the bridge, because, you know, this is a spiritual experience. Having been for the last few years, we'll see what happens with this pandemic. I suspect that the next one is going to be devoted to the memory of John Lewis, but I wanted to talk about the bridge, because there is a major push that is likely to come to fruition that the Edmund Pettus Bridge be changed to the John Lewis Memorial Bridge. But one of the things that we have talked about with some of the local organizers was also the need to recognize Amelia Boynton, you know, who lived to be, I think, 109 years old, or certainly beyond 105. I mean, she lived, and one of those great images of her going across that bridge with, I think, Obama holding her hand, and actually Regent Dr. Adlai Sanford, you know, next to her and all that, one of the great images that you'll ever see. But one of the things that you and I have talked about, and I mentioned to you, is the idea that, you know, because some people wanted to push to have the bridge named after Amelia Boynton, because she was a local person and had been involved for years and years and was brutally, brutally trampled and beaten on that day. The idea that maybe the bridge may be named after Congressman John Lewis, but maybe the highway or the road, the street might be named Amelia Boynton Way. What do you think about that?
Well, that has been in the conversation, and I think that's wholly appropriate, because the Boyntons went back, you know, decades. Amelia Boynton and her husband sent the first letter to Dr. King to come to Selma, the Dallas County Voters League, and I mean, for God's sake, we talk about Amelia Boynton. I mean, you almost can't exclude, and we just lost him recently, the Reverend F.D. Reese.
When
you start picking and choosing names, you know, the thing I understand about John Lewis, I'm told, and we never got a chance to talk about it, was that he was not necessarily in favor of having that bridge named after him. And if that is true, I would hypothesize it's because he knew and knows how many other names are etched on that bridge in blood. But I agree with you. I think that at the very least, we have to think about others and how they should be named and memorialized on that bridge. And whether it's the John Lewis Bridge or whether the street is named after someone else. I just came to mind while I'm talking to you. You know, that highway, I can't think of the name of it, is it 51? That highway that runs between Selma and Montgomery,
right?
You know,
yes.
You know, rename the whole highway. and at different points. They already have the markers for the campsites. Because though you don't know, they camped out at night. See, we all too bougie to do that today in 2020. Them folks, Dr. King and slept outside. They set up campsites and tents. And Harry Belafonte and Tony Bennett brought all of their Hollywood friends, Sammy Davis Jr. and everybody, to perform at each campsite every night. It was amazing. And so, USAID, thank you. To name a different stretch, each stretch along USAID, after Amelia Boynton, after F.B. Reese, you know, after some of the others whose names, I think that would be, I would argue for naming a different section after each one of those individuals. I think it's long overdue, and it's absolutely necessary.
Well, Reverend Mark Thompson, I've certainly learned a lot today just listening to you, and I hope our audience has done as well in terms of the role that you have played in this struggle and really why we have gone back and again, time and time again, to Selma. There's a way in which this moment sort of magnifies that. And we hope that people will take this moment to think about C.T. Vivian, to think about Representative John Lewis, to think about Amelia Boynton, you know, which I would sort of magnify to some degree, because I think there's also a way in which women like Diane Nash, who's gotten some major recognition in Ella Baker and others, but I still think we need to elevate women more, because when you go to Atlanta, for example, you see all the names after all the men, you know, but you don't see many named after women. But I want to thank you so much for joining us in this conversation, and give people again the place that they can go and see the videos that you referenced earlier, because I think people will want to rush and see those.
Well, you can go on YouTube / Make It Plain, or you can listen at makeitplain.com, either one. And, you know, on Twitter and Facebook, Make It Plain as well. You can see all of them there. And Dr. Daniels, appreciate you. And your stalwartness and, you know, keeping these ancestors and their names alive. That is very, very important. And as African people, if we believe in the way that we do, C.T. Vivian and John Lewis can never leave us.
That's right.
We can never stop fighting. And so we should just wake up every morning and thank God for them and say, you know, good morning, newly crowned ancestors.
What trouble
shall we get into today?
That's right. Well, thank you so much. Really appreciate it. All right. That was Reverend Mark Thompson, who's a longtime friend of mine. We've worked together for many years, but he is also the producer of the podcast, Make It Plain, and much more than that, as you can hear by what he had to say. Well, I'd like to close out the show today with two commentaries, if you will. The first one is a commentary about the bill and the bridge. And I gave a hint of it a moment ago when I talked about the Edmund Pettus Bridge. And so I want to say that as far as Dr. Ron Daniels is concerned, take down the name of Edmund Pettus, the Confederate general and the Grand Dragon of the Alabama Ku Klux Klan, and replace it with the name of Representative John Lewis, who shed blood on that bridge, who was brutally beaten on that bridge, almost to death on that bridge. And so I want to see it renamed, because I think metaphorically, you know, you could talk about lots of people on Martin Luther King Street, but King sort of, he is the metaphor for all of them, right? And so I don't have a problem with the bridge being named after Representative John Lewis, the John Lewis Memorial Bridge, given all that he fought for and that he exemplifies in terms of the struggle for voting rights and our participation in saying. But I also believe that we need to uplift the women who were involved in the struggle. And Amelia Boynton, as you just heard, also shed blood on that bridge that day, trampled and beaten near death. A local stalwart. John Lewis was not from Selma. The Boynton family was. And they had expended great sacrifice fighting for freedom there. And so I think to elevate this woman freedom fighter by having the street that runs across the bridge called the Amelia Boynton Way would be an appropriate way to remember and memorialize her life and legacy as well. And again, the other thing I think is incredibly important is the bill. There's a bill for the Congress of the United States. It's called H.R. 4. It is hung up by some of these hypocrites who are now hailing John Lewis, right? He was such a this and he was such a that and so forth. And John Lewis would bring them to Selma every year as a part of faith and politics. In fact, I agree with John Lewis on some things and others. Well, I would have done it differently. But we had to sit through at Brown Memorial that some of these hypocrites would get up and talk about this and that and then go back without having Klansmen sheets on to, in fact, either block progressive policy or, in fact, to advance Ku Klux Klan-type policies. And so H.R. 4 should be named the John Lewis Voting Rights Bill. Straightforward. Pass the House of Representatives and put it right on Mitch McConnell's desk and expose him as either a hypocrite or compel them to, in fact, do something different. That's my commentary on John Lewis in terms of what I see there. Now I have another one I want to put out there. And it's like, where is Kanye West when we need him? Oh, yes. Where is Kanye West when we need him? Well, you know, they said that Kanye West is an eclectic genius. I don't know. I mean, he's brilliant. Everybody says he's brilliant, but he is eclectic. I can remember he had a Confederate. You're talking about removing the Confederate flag. I remember he had a hat on with the Confederate stars and bars in it. Unapologetically, he didn't seem to care and whatever. And as you well know, he has a pal. His buddy is Agent Orange or the Orange Man. Him and the Orange Man are tight. Now, do you remember Katrina? Back during Katrina, you know, Kanye West got up one day and something hit him. He said, George Bush does not like black people. And he was right. He gave a righteous narrative. He was correct. And so I'm wondering whether or not he can speak some truth now. Kanye West, we need you now. You met with Trump at the Trump Tower. You welcomed him, you were filmed with him in the Oval Office, and you were palling around with him. Well, Kanye, we need you now. It's time for you to call your buddy out. Donald Trump does not like black people. Kanye, say it. Donald Trump does not like black people. Kanye, where are you when we need you? Well, this is the professor, Dr. Ron Daniels. We hope that you have enjoyed this edition of Vantage Point here on 99.5 FM in collaboration with YCRadio.org. And we'll be right back again with you here next week on Vantage Point.